first thing I want to say is that it's very, very warm, and I wonder if people could maybe open any windows over there as well as the ones over there, if it's at all possible. Not by looking at them, gentlemen, but by... will strings pull? Can they open at all? Or thank you very much. Yes. Yes, yes. This is the graveyard shift, as it's called sometimes, isn't it? I can shed a little light on what David was speaking about, how you get chosen to do this, and not so much that the principles by which it operates, but the mechanism. I received a letter back just before Easter. In actual fact, it arrived on Good Friday, significantly. From Sandy, and it just looked like an ordinary invitation to a CREEF meeting. It was on the same paper, the same typeface, everything inside. That's what I read it as. And noticed a sort of a personalized dear Dominic instead of dear colleague or something, and didn't make anything of it. And I thought, this is well in advance of October. But read on, and read that we were going to have an exposition of the next bit of John. Great. And then we were going to have something on postmodernism. Thought, excellent, good. Very, very, very helpful. And then it said, and you've been asked to do it. And so then I phoned Sandy and said yes. And yes, absolutely. Straight in there. No messing. And then Sandy, harmless as doves but wise as, said, well, there'll be John before lunch, and I suddenly realized that what he hadn't written in the letter was that postmodernism would come after lunch. And so I hope that nobody will fall asleep. The room is warm, our stomachs are full, and everything else. For those of you who worship at the feet of George B. Duncan and like alliteration's artful aid, we are about to have postprandial perambulations down postmodernism's peculiar pathways. Now, I don't want to start out with a quick definition of postmodernism. Instead, I want to describe something to you. I'm going to do two things this afternoon, and we'll have a hymn about halfway through. What I want to do, first of all, is to paint a portrait, as it says on the handouts here, of two postmoderns who are called Najat and Fiona. And I know Najat and Fiona, but they're not actually called Najat and Fiona, but you know what I mean. And then what I want to do is to step back from the portrait that's been painted and look at the palette that has been chosen to paint that portrait, to look at four major themes of postmodernism. And I will be quoting from a few different people, and we will, I hope, as we do that, begin to understand just what postmodernism is and isn't. The handouts are the way we do them at our own church with a Bible study. What I've given you is basically not the content, but the headings. And the idea is that then you can write in the content underneath the headings and thus stay awake or fan yourself with them. And there's plenty of room for doodling as well on them. I've also included a small reading list. There are many other books which doubtless many of you have all read to great depth and know far more about it than anybody else here, certainly me. There are a few books there which are very, very helpful indeed. Some of you have also read Mark Knoll's book, The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, and there are others as well. But that's just a little bit of reading for those who want to take it further. And I hope you find it helpful. I didn't put the prices on there at all. Should also say, before we start looking at Najat and Fiona, that the original intention for this address was that I review Don Carson's book, The Gagging of God. Now, The Gagging of God is a wonderful book, but it's 570 pages then everything else. And the thought of reviewing The Gagging of God after lunch was even more awesome than the thought of just looking at postmodernism after lunch. So I will be referring to it, but not doing the book review of The Gagging of God. I know several people who've got well beyond page 30 of The Gagging of God. And that's 30 half pages, because the footnotes on each page are quite extensive. But we'll refer to it. Strictly speaking, The Gagging of God is about pluralism, which, as we'll see, is one aspect of postmodernism. And there are one or two things that we need to understand before we understand pluralism in order to set pluralism in its proper context. So, Najat and Fiona, and I'll describe them to you, and then we'll begin to examine the palette with which their picture has been painted. They are in their late 20s and early 30s. Najat is 31. He is an accountant, and he's doing fairly well in what is largely a young firm in Glasgow. And Fiona is 29. She, like Najat, studied at university. She is now working, has recently got a job in a large supermarket chain in their customer relations department. They are living together, despite their parents' initial disapproval, but now their parents are quite happy, because they're happy and they're nice young folk. Najat's parents are Indian, or of Indian origin, but they fled Idi Amin's Uganda in the early 1970s. And Najat's dad entered his uncle's fruit and veg firm, also runs a newsagent's store, or three. Najat's parents drive a Nissan. Now, I don't want to suggest that if you drive a Nissan, you're going to have postmodernist children, but they drive a Nissan. Fiona's parents are from Perth, and his dad worked in insurance. He is a keen golfer and therefore rarely in the kirk on Sunday mornings. His mum was once a nurse and is in the church 2 out of every 5 Sundays, but there is a stiff chance that Najat's dad will probably be an elder in the not-too-distant future because there aren't that many others around. They drive a Rover. Don't know why, but they drive a Rover. Anyway, the parents are quite happy now that Najat and Fiona are living together, and they have come round to seeing that maybe there's not so much wrong in it anyway, and at least they love each other, and they're very happy and not doing anybody any harm. They live in a first-floor flat in Kelvinside, and their names are on a nice Rennie Macintosh brass plate on the door. Their flat, and I'm going to speak a little about their flat, because the environment and the way we create our own space is fundamental to postmodernism. Their flat is comfortable. It is very carefully decorated. On the walls, you will see icons from Byzantium, not real ones, but they're imitation ones, and Russia. You will see 2 modern paintings, or prints at least, by Ben Nicholson and Paul Klee. The architectural style is reflected, of Glasgow, is reflected in several architectural type paintings of Glasgow buildings, and particularly the university where they studied and met together. And there are several Islamic style wall hangings around as well. On the various surfaces in their living room, there are wrought iron candlesticks with lamps on them. And there is stripped pine, there is mahogany, and there are lots and lots of very mixed ornaments around. They have an extremely nice sound system, not stereo. Their parents brought stereos. They have sound systems, and it's a very nice one indeed, and it's one of those Bang & Olufsen ones that you just wave your hand in front and the door opens. And I know a minister with one of those. And if you go through their CDs, you will see a very, very eclectic collection. Nat King Cole, Rub Shoulders with Mozart, Carols from Kings is side by side with Madonna, Leslie Garrett, Gregorian Chant, U2, Sting, and Bananarama. They have very eclectic taste. Najat's notebook PC is modem linked to the office. And naturally, they surf the internet at regular intervals. On TV, they like to watch Rugby, Panorama, and Coronation Street, Chicago Hope. They video old films because they're very quaint and engaging, and they also occasionally video Blue Peter just for a laugh. For themselves, Najat and Fiona enjoy weekends with their friends from university days. Their friends also shop at Sainsbury's Next and Marks and Spencer's. Their friends and Najat and Fiona meet up every New Year at a hotel near Perth. And they have a night there and have a fine time. And that's gone on now for 5 or 6 years. Amongst their friends are those who are single and living as single, and those who are cohabiting, those who are married, and there has been one divorce already amongst their friends who are their sort of age. They are very, very nice. They are nice people. And if you were ever to take Najat and Fiona's wedding, you would find them extremely thoughtful. You would find them on the surface very open. They would enjoy coming to your church, and they would find your sermons intellectually engaging, and they would go away and think about them afterwards. They are very, very nice. They are polite. They are broadly tolerant. They are unperturbed by what would once have been frowned upon, in particular their cohabitation. They are very concerned about the environment indeed. They are very concerned about political hypocrisy. They belong to very few organizations. They have membership of the Worldwide Fund for Nature, and that's the only organization that they actually belong to. They hate animal testing of cosmetics, and they're very concerned about personal finances. Not that they need to worry too much about them at the moment, but if they ever have children, they will. They do not take advice very readily. They will listen politely but not take the advice unless they have asked for it. And they don't often ask their parents, but they ask their own pals, their friends. Fiona asks her granddad, for whom she has a particular fondness. They believe in something. And if eventually they come to you about their wedding, then they will say that they believe in something, and they believe in God, and they believe there's got to be more to this life than just earning your money. They are a little concerned about life's meaning. And they may come along several times to church and will pose in many ways, not deliberately, but just almost naturally, as young folk for whom the church should be making room. They will very openly talk about the faith. They are not hostile towards the faith on the surface at all. Now that's Najat and Fiona, and I want you to bear them in mind, because as we go through all the heavy philosophical stuff and all the rest of it, I will try and relate what we're going through to Najat and Fiona, and that may help just to ground it a little in the world that we're more familiar with. That's the portrait. What are the colours that have gone into the palette for painting that portrait? We go to the most important colour first. This is the colour which has been the wash on the canvas, and it will pick out all the highlights. It is the colour which is mixed with most other colours. This is the really important colour in the palette for Najat and Fiona's portrait. There is no big story. And if you want to understand postmodernism, then you have to get a grip of that foundational, if we can use the term with respect to postmodernism, that foundational feature of it. There is no big story. Jean-François Lyotard, fantastic name, must have invented aerobics or something. Jean-François Lyotard is a French-speaking philosopher, French philosopher, and he wrote for the Council of Quebec, the Council of Universities, back in 1979, a paper called The Postmodern Condition, a Report on Knowledge, and that's available in English, and it's published in 1984. And in that report to the Council of Universities, Jean-François Lyotard defined postmodern and the postmodern condition, which is described by postmodernism as incredulity toward meta-narratives. Now, if you came along today looking for a nice, easy definition of postmodernism, you will probably not recognize it in that phrase, incredulity towards meta-narratives. But that's the language that a lot of the writers on postmodernism will use. And if we can cope with some aspects of our own theological language, I'm sure we can cope with this one. Incredulity, we know what that is. Meta-narratives are the big stories. Meta-narratives are the grand intellectual themes that will function in particular ways that I'll outline in a moment, but which dominate. Meta-narratives are big pictures into which everything else fits. And in a moment, after we've looked at the big stories and why there are no big stories according to postmodernism, we'll look at why this is a better definition than some of the ones that we might come across. Meta-narratives need describing a little for you then. Meta-narratives have three particular properties about them. Meta-narratives, first of all, have what are called foundational claims. That is, meta-narratives claim to be able to provide a foundation for sure knowledge, a foundation for certainty about the world in which we live and about ourselves in it. They have foundational claims. Secondly, they have all exerted dominant influences from time to time on philosophy and the arts, on education, on politics and social organization, on theology and metaphysics. They have had dominating influences in these spheres. Thirdly, meta-narratives have all been criticized by other meta-narratives. They are set in opposition to each other, opposition which often comes out of one analyzing another. So they have been criticized, and they criticize each other. Now, modernism is primarily and fundamentally the view that there is a meta-narrative. And postmodernism is the view that there are no big stories anymore. Modernism, fundamentally, there is a meta-narrative. In actual fact, there are several meta-narratives, and there have been many meta-narratives. Some of the big ones are these. First of all, the big story of reason. And we would trace that back mostly, I suppose, to about 1637 when René Descartes published his Discourse on Method, chopped it up into six parts, but the second one is the one that contains that famous bit where Descartes sort of wants to find out what he can be certain about, what the foundation is, and he starts eliminating everything in the world outside himself, the extended world, including even his own body, and the thing which is going to provide him with certainty, the thing that he can have no doubt over, is that he is thinking. His rationality, and I think therefore I am, and he has this thinking thing, and the extended thing is everything else. Now, that when Descartes published that in 1637, he set in train a massive meta-narrative. Sometimes we might call it the Enlightenment Project. Sometimes it is called rationalism or empiricism. Francis Bacon will be dragged in there, and many others too. Some folk would call it the Enlightenment meta-narrative. But the big story is the big story of reason, logic, rationality. Another big story would be beauty, the Romanticists. Now, Descartes wrote in 1637, we don't need to go all that far ahead, only until about 1820, until we see a Romanticist meta-narrative being bandied around all over the place. I pick 1820 simply because that's when Keats wrote his poem Ode on a Grecian Urn, which some of you may have been familiar with. And in the last line of Ode on a Grecian Urn, the last couplet, Keats says, "Beauty is truth, truth beauty, that is all ye know on earth and all ye need to know." And Keats there was expressing the Romanticist big story, the Romanticist meta-narrative. Not reason, not rationality, not empiricism, but beauty. Beauty is truth. Truth, beauty, that is all ye know on earth and all ye need to know. Another meta-narrative would be Marxism. The meta-narrative which has to do with the emancipation of the working subject. Another meta-narrative would be capitalist democracy. And obviously Marxism and capitalist democracy don't go very well together. Another meta-narrative would be existentialism. Existentialism is a way of looking at the world. It's not just a particular philosophy. You have existentialists as diverse as Nietzsche on the one hand and Bultmann on the other. Some people wouldn't see them as being terribly diverse, but they are diverse. At least one believes in God. you can decide which one. Now, the way of looking at the world, which places the knowing subject at the center of things, and the existence of the person who is looking at the world at the center of things, is that existentialist meta-narrative. Now, the reason why Jean-François Lyotard's definition is better than some others is that some others simply stop there when they are defining postmodernism. As if postmodernism was simply a movement away from things since Descartes. But postmodernism is a movement away from all meta-narratives. That means it is a movement away from meta-narratives that come from other places. And it is also a movement away from meta-narratives that have been around since long before Descartes was even thought of. We have a meta-narrative. Our big story is God himself. His truth. All truth is his. He is truth. God himself is our meta-narrative. And the postmodernists would be as uncomfortable with our meta-narrative as they would with far more recent ones like the rationalist one, which is why Lyotard's definition is much better than simply saying postmodernism is against rationalism. It's against an awful lot more than rationalism, as we will see. So there are these meta-narratives, and they function in these three particular, or they have these three particular properties: the foundational claims, they exert dominating influences in particular areas of our culture and thought. And they've all been criticized, they've criticized each other, and they've replaced each other to some extent or another. Now, meta-narratives function in a particular way, and it's the way that they function which has led largely to their downfall. First of all, meta-narratives function, big stories function, by providing a unifying system of thought into which all other ideas can be ordered. One of the reasons why one big story gets replaced by another is that it suddenly can't cope with all the little facts and the little observations and all the rest of it, so it needs to be replaced. It provides this unifying system of thought into which all other thoughts can be ordered. Sometimes that system might be called a matrix. Sometimes, after Thomas Kuhn, writing in the late 60s, early 70s, it would be called a paradigm. So they provide the context, the system of thought into which everything else can be fitted, slotted, ordered, and all the rest of it. They therefore provide a matrix, a paradigm, into which other thoughts cohere. When you are ordering your ideas, you aren't simply placing them in some sort of relation to the big story. You're placing them in relation to one another. Now, if we were to look at the painting on the wall over there, of the chap on the horse pointing his finger, if I was Scottish, I'd probably know who he was. And if I'd done my research better, I would have known it. But if you were to remove the head of the horse from the picture and stick it on the wall somewhere over there, then you would not only have failed to understand the head of the horse in relation to the rest of the picture, but you would have failed to understand the whole canvas. But you would have failed to see the head of the horse in relation to the man's head, the horse's legs, everything else. Meta-narratives provide the cohesion for our ideas that makes them work together and stick together. The consistency, we might sometimes call it, which our ideas would have. Third way in which meta-narratives function is by providing a direction for history. If you have a big story, then you have some way of defining what is progress and what isn't. Now, obviously, history is progressing in entirely different ways if you are a capitalist democrat or you are a Marxist. History is going in different ways at different rates if you are a rationalist or a romanticist. History is going in different ways if you are a Christian or an atheistic existentialist. And it is the big story that provides a sense of direction for history, that provides a progress, if you like, from one place to another. Fourth, meta-narratives function, big stories function, in a way which helps you to assess the truthfulness of statements. So Keats writes, beauty is truth and truth beauty. And Descartes is sitting there in the background saying, I'm not sure that we can even think about that statement in the context of truthfulness or untruthfulness, because you can't approach it in any of the normal ways of justification. Or some of the positivists, if you're familiar with them, like A.J. Eyre in Britain, the folk like Wittgenstein would be a positivist, and others would say, well, that statement, beauty is truth and truth beauty, is meaningless because you can't go out and test it analytically against any particular observable evidence. So you see, your big story functions by providing you with a means of assessing the truthfulness, the meaningfulness of everybody else's statements. Now that leads to the fifth thing about meta-narratives, big stories, and it is this, that they provide a means, and this is largely a criticism of them that comes from some folk, they provide a means of social control, oppression, marginalization, or manipulation. Because if you and your group, which hold to one particular meta-narrative, big story, have positions of power, then you can decide that what others have are wrong. And you can marginalize them. And you can silence your critics if your critics believe something fundamentally different from what you believe. And history is littered with examples of big stories providing means of social control. We've, in the extremely recent past, seen the breakdown of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of communism. Well, if ever there was a meta-narrative that provided a means of social control, it was Marxism or Stalinism. Now, that's how they function. But postmodernism is coming along and saying there is no big story because of these things that I've hinted at here. It's not just saying, well, we don't like the idea of somebody telling us what to believe. There's more to it than that. There's more to it than that. In the first place, there's no big story because modernism and the big stories have not delivered the goods. People look around them and see a world which is heavily polluted, which is torn apart by war, which is riddled with social inequalities and lousy buildings, and our cities and environments are terrible. Modernism has not delivered the goods. Where is the progress that whoever's meta-narrative is supposed to have promised us? Where is it? We are in a mess. Your big stories haven't worked. Second, there is no big story according to modernism because there are just so many stories to read nowadays. There are just so many stories. Men's and women's views of the world and the universe and self are very, very different. Are they not? Najat is discovering that even as we speak, and so is Fiona. Najat and Fiona see on their TV screens the massive otherness, the complete difference of non-Western cultures. And they understand that difference better than many of our forefathers did. And they see not simply their own particular world and other people's cultures and other ways of looking at the world, they see the whole lot mixed together. The whole lot mixed together. And that is happening in no small measure because we see an absolute mushrooming of the communications media these days. One writer, David Lyon, has parodied Einstein's E equals MC squared by saying P for postmodernism equals CM squared. And CM is communications media and consumer markets. Najat and Fiona are in touch with a world which is massively varied, and it is all immediately accessible to them at the click of a few buttons. They can go shopping in America from their own front room on the internet. Third, big stories have collapsed, according to postmodernism, because ultimately they're all a matter of perspective. Where you are does affect what you see. Your paradigm, your thought world, where you are in relation to particular big stories does affect what you see. Who you are affects what you see as well. If your paradigm counts, your person counts. We bring to our understanding of the world the ability to commit ourselves to it and listen to it and try and understand it as it is and as it would shape our thinking. Or we can bring to the world our preset ideas. Our person counts. Michael Polanyi's book, Personal Knowledge, has influenced a great many folk who would be critics of big stories, even though they might not necessarily be postmodernists themselves. Your paradigm counts as part of your perspective. Your person counts as part of your perspective. And what you've got in your life counts because it affects your perspective, your phenomena. And the big stories have been very heavily criticized by folk called phenomenologists who say when you come and look at the world, you are bringing to it all the world of your own that's defined by your own horizons, whether they're personal, social, cultural, intellectual, whatever. But you have your own horizons. And when you come and look at something, if it's a text on in a book, whether it's something that you're going to look at scientifically, whether it's trying to understand the person you're married to or whatever, then you are bringing that world and all that's in it to your understanding. And yet they have their own world and the text has its own world. Your phenomena, the things in your horizon, in your view, affect what you see. Some of you will be familiar with Hans-Georg Gadamer's work, The Fusion of Horizons. That's not the title of his book. The title of his book is Hermeneutical Philosophical Hermeneutics, which is a right put-off. But some of you will be familiar with the word Horizonts Verschmelzung. Some of you. don't forget it. Fusing of horizons. That when you come and look at a text, you try and put aside for a moment what's in your horizon, you understand the horizon of the author of the text, and then you let that reshape your horizon as you fuse the two together, which is what you would try and do when you're trying to do your exegesis, presumably. Fourth, big stories have collapsed, so say the postmodernists, because of the ability to construct your own reality, in fact, the necessity of constructing your own reality. You can't jump outside your own knowledge and language and perception of the world in order to test your own knowledge and language of the world. So all the time you are in fact constructing your own reality. Legoland and Disneyland are excellent pictures of a postmodern world. You're constructing your reality. Now I've had several quotes which I've passed over because time will pass too quickly for us to enjoy them. But let me quote to you a little bit from Richard Rorty, who is a postmodernist writer. To the postmodernist mind, we have no access to something called reality, apart, and reality is in inverted commas. We have no access to something called reality apart from that which we represent as reality in our concepts, language, and discourse. Since we never encounter reality except under a chosen description, we are denied the luxury or pretense of claiming immediate access to the world. We can never get outside our knowledge to check its accuracy against objective reality. Our access is always mediated by our own linguistic and conceptual constructions, wrote Richard Rorty. You can't jump out of your own skin to see what your skin looks like, if you like. So we necessarily, therefore, construct our own reality. Reality is what you make it. There is no big story. No big story at all, says postmodernism. Now I think that would be a good time for us to stop and sing. And I would like us to sing 699. Second major colour on the Pomo palette. for painting the portrait of Najat and Fiona. Sorry for the alliterations. Again, it's starting to happen accidentally, which must be a dangerous thing. If you've got a grasp of there being no big stories, then you will see that it is a short step to incoherence. Without the meta-narrative, nothing hangs together anymore. Now, I want to just mention the incoherence with respect to these three things: double coding, direction and progress, and then meaning, what meaning. First of all, you will find in Najat and Fiona's flat things which are ancient, things which are modern, things which are definitely not belonging to, say, a rationalist techno-science world, and things which are. Their notebook PC, the stereo TV and all the rest of it, and yet the icons from Byzantium. And this sort of wrought iron, mock verdigris old lamp that they've got there, which was actually quite new out of the Pastimes catalogue last year. Now, one of the writers on postmodernism, postmodernism in architecture, Charles Jenks, who is an architect but chiefly a writer on architecture, and postmodernism is a word which really achieved its major currency in the world of architecture. That's where it really gathered its currency and then expanded from there. Charles Jenks writes about this fact that postmodernism looks backwards and also rejects what it's looking at. It looks at the techno-science and all the rest of it, uses it, but then rejects it to look for something else. He writes about it in the context of architecture as double coding. And if you thought that the gagging of God was bad, then you should read Lawrence Cahoon's From Modernism to Postmodernism. In actual fact, the gagging of God is very good. And so is this one. This is from Charles Jenks. Very, very readable book, What is Postmodernism? Here we go. He defines postmodernism in terms of this double coding. It is the combination of modern techniques with something else, usually traditional building, in order for architecture to communicate with the public and a concerned minority, usually other architects. Today's postmodern architects were trained by modernists and are committed to using contemporary technology as well as facing current social reality. The most notable and perhaps the best use of this double coding, the techno-science, the technology, and yet looking for something maybe older, something maybe newer, something different which doesn't belong to technology. The most notable and perhaps the best use of this double coding in architecture is James Stirling's addition to the Staatsgalerie in Stuttgart. Here one can find the fabric of the city and the existing museum extended in amusing and ironic ways. I always find it strange when people describe buildings as amusing. But anyway, the U-shaped palazzo form of the old gallery is echoed and placed on a high plinth or acropolis above the traffic. But this classical base holds, which would love, Prince Charles would love, it's that kind of building, holds a very real and necessary parking garage. One that is ironically indicated by stones which have fallen like ruins to the ground. The resultant holes show the real construction, not thick marble blocks of the real Acropolis, but a steel frame holding stone cladding which allows the air ventilation required by law. One can sit on these false ruins and ponder the truth of our lost innocence. But we live in an age which can build with beautiful, expressive masonry, as long as we make it skin deep and hang it on a steel skeleton. There is the building in New York, which looks like a lovely modern skyscraper, but has a lovely Chippendale scroll top. It's that kind of double coding. Combine the modern with the non-modern. And that is an aspect of postmodernism's incoherence, which many of us might look upon and just see a whole mass of self-contradiction. But it's deliberate. It's very deliberate. Second, because of the incoherence that comes from a lack of a big picture, ideas like direction and progress are rejected. Who are you to define what progress is? Who are you to define what direction is? Now, we can see an illustration of that when we use another post-word, post-colonialism. You go to a post-colonial city, and you see that that city was once built by people who had a very clear sense of what was progress and direction. They laid out streets, they built buildings in a particular style, they laid out gardens. They organized the city as they built it. They had a clear idea of what was progress and what wasn't. And then we enter the post-colonial age and nobody seems to know where the city is going anymore. And it all starts to fall apart, and the fabric of many post-colonial cities does fall apart because nobody knows what to do with it. Nobody knows where to take it anymore because the big story has gone. Take away the big story and you lose progress, direction, whether that's expressed in town planning or in a whole lot of other ways. But third, and most disturbingly or keenly for us, you lose meaning. You lose meaning. Remember that the meta-narratives define what is true, false, and how you decide it. The meta-narratives decide what is acceptable and where it fits in with everything else. The meta-narrative, the big story, by providing a context, provides meaning. That horse's head means something where it is. It means nothing if it was ripped out and put somewhere else. Okay? Meaning disappears. Now, meaning disappears partly just because of the context of the big picture being missing, but also because that big picture, as it disappears, takes away with it a unifying consensus about what things mean and what words might mean. In Najat and Fiona's flat, there are the icons, and there's the Ben Nicholson and Paul Klee work. Now, anybody who thinks like Ben Nicholson or Paul Klee does not think like the people who produced the icons. The people who produced the icons believed in God, and the image was there to point them to God as a sign. Whereas the work of Nicholson and Klee and others is pointing only to human rationality and human order, and some of Ben Nicholson's nice blocky sort of work, nice straight lines, right angles, that sort of thing. Nothing that's really going to grip you by your emotions. It's going to appeal to your reason. But because the icons have been taken away from the context of belief in God, they can sit on the wall right next to Ben Nicholson and Paul Klee's work, and nobody bats an eyelid. They look quite nice together. Bit of diversity, bit of variety. I like them both anyway. They both do something for me. The real danger, though, is that meaning disappears because this unifying consensus disappears. The unifying consensus. We cannot appeal to a commonly held, commonly believed and accepted, commonly submitted to big story. So what something, whether it's a picture or a poem or a passage in scripture, means is really only what it means to me. Meaning becomes localized. It becomes privatized. Meaning is personalized. Meaning becomes what it means to me or to those few of us who share my particular standpoint, who would understand my joke because they went to the same school that I went to, or whatever. Now, when meaning disappears because there is no big story, then several things follow. First of all, metaphysics loses its ground. It ceases to be a relevant question anymore. And it loses its ground to pragmatics and to technology. The question becomes not what does this mean, but what will this accomplish? The question becomes not what does this text mean, but what can I accomplish with this text? And that's a fundamentally different question. That is the question of the pragmatist, the utilitarian, the technologist. And we see the reflection of that in our postmodern cultures in the way that universities have changed. Universities were built originally on metaphysics. Metaphysics go, so we see a rash of pragmatic and technological universities. University of Highlands and Islands. The questions therefore become, and the questions that young folk who are going through our universities become not why I am here, but how can my being here become more efficient, more fun, more enjoyable? How can it be more useful? Not why is there something rather than nothing, but where's McDonald's? I need lunch. They become pragmatic questions, not metaphysical questions. Third, and we'll not bother with the examples in science, but we'll look at the examples in hermeneutics. We begin to lose the capacity to approach texts in the way that we here have always approached them. Our hermeneutics change significantly. Words are regarded as signs. Now, signs are regarded as signs because there is a distinction between the thing that is pointing and the thing that it is pointing to. In the language of Jacques Derrida and others, the signifier, the signpost, and the signified, the thing that it's pointing to. Words are signs. And they are signs because there is something else to point to. There is a meaning that these words indicate, signify. If you take away the big picture, the meta-narrative, that provides the context which decides meaning, then you've lost the distinction between a sign and the thing signified. You just have the word. You just have the text in front of you. Now, that is a massive shift to take place. Whether it takes place in the seemingly remote world of academic hermeneuticists, or whatever they call themselves, or whether it takes place at a popular level. Because what it means is that you devalue words, because the value of words as signs is found in what they are pointing to, and their effectiveness in pointing to it. If you destroy the distinction between signified and signifier, then you have devalued a word. And when you have devalued the word, you can then reevaluate it according to what you want it to mean. Now, that's the essential process of deconstructionism. And some of you have been waiting for me to mention Jacques Derrida and deconstructionism, and folk have been stopping me and saying, oh, you're going to mention Jacques Derrida and all the rest of it. Well, that's the essential process that Jacques Derrida and other deconstructionists. Jacques Derrida is really a post-structuralist. If you want to impress someone, or think you're impressing them, tell them he's not actually a deconstructionist. He's a post-structuralist. And Stanley Fish would be another one. You revalue words according to whatever value you want them to have. Sometimes it's called reader response hermeneutics. It is the response that the word creates in the world, the mind, the heart of the reader, that is the crucial thing. There are versions of that in Richard Rorty's hermeneutics of solidarity and in other particular ways of doing this kind of hermeneutics. Now, let me string together one or two quotes. I'm not maybe going to have that much time for questions, but maybe we'll all be too tired for questions anyway. Let me just string together one or two quotes. First from Don Carson here in The Gagging of God from page 29. In academic biblical studies, postmodernism links with the new literary criticism to create endless fresh readings, many of them clever and parts of them insightful, even if taken as a whole, their insight is more and more removed from reasoned and defensible anchorage in the text. Well, now we know why it's more and more removed from reasoned and defensible anchorage in the text. Because the fresh readings come entirely from the world of the reader. Let me read to you a little bit more from Roger London, Anthony Thistleton, and Clarence Walhoot. I think it's pronounced Walhoot. It could be something else. If somebody knows, tell me afterwards, please. They are quoting and dissecting the work of Stanley Fish. The reader's response, write Fish, the reader's response to a text is not the response to the meaning, it is the meaning. Oof. Ooh, that's fairly blunt and massive. He goes on. Expressed negatively, A text does not generate determinate meaning independently of social and institutional circumstances. The reader and the reader's social, ethical, intellectual community contribute decisively, not to the final interpretation of what the text means, as if the meaning lay somewhere else, but contribute decisively to the final meaning of the text. The reader's response is not to the meaning, it is the meaning. What does John 1:1-14 mean? It means however you respond to it. That's what it means. And there is no meaning out there. There is no objective meaning. Meaning lies not with the author's world, which we cannot get into. We deconstruct it from the author's world. We desediment it from all the layers of the author's own particular world. Derrida also used the word desedimentation. You peel back all the layers of sediment that belong to the author's world and just look at the text as if it was written this morning, and it means what you, with your own constructs, want it to mean. Now, you would see, therefore, the shift that has taken place with postmodernism. It comes from the lack of a big narrative and the incoherence. We have moved from the days of absolutes through the days of relative absolutes. That is, within your worldview, things operate as absolutes. Within my worldview, things operate as absolutes, and they're all relative. The world of relative absolutes. We have now shifted to the world of absolute relativism, as Derrida calls it. Absolute relativism. And if you can construct the meaning of a text, or you can construct the meaning of an event, or you can construct the meaning of anything, a person, for instance, then you can construct your own reality. You and those who think like you can construct your own world. And that world is reality. It's not just your version of reality, as if reality was something else that we all had different versions of. It is reality. Let me find London's quote here in this book. And this makes the point very well. Roger London is quoting Fish again. As Fish puts it, the vocabulary of postmodernity is committed to promoting a visions of humans as the species Homo rhetoricus rather than Homo seriosus. To define Homo rhetoricus, Fish quotes Richard Lanham, theorist of rhetoric. Homo rhetoricus assumes a natural agility in changing orientations. From birth almost, he has dwelt not in a single value structure, but in several. He is thus committed to no single construction of the world. He accepts the present paradigm and explores its resources. Rhetorical man is not trained to discover reality, but to manipulate it. Reality is what is accepted as reality, what is useful. Picking up the argument on his own, Fish explains that rhetorical man manipulates reality, establishing through his words the imperatives and urgencies to which he and his fellows must respond. Perhaps the most important thing to understand about Homo rhetoricus is that by exploring the available means of persuasion in a particular situation, he tries them on, and as they begin to suit him, he becomes them. He becomes them. Reality is just whatever you choose reality to be. Now, examples in the popular culture are myriad. In the first place, it means the triumph of the image over meaning. Images don't point to anything anymore. The icons don't point to God anymore. They just look nice on the wall. The icon is just a thing in itself. And so we have a character like Madonna, who constantly reinvents her own image. And it doesn't matter that one year she is something which is a flat contradiction of what she is the next year. And all she ever wants to be taken as is the image at that moment. And she's not going to take them too seriously because she knows she's going to change it. Madonna. We have the proliferation of spin doctors who place the construction on reality that they want other people to accept. We have what some people have called postmodernism. We have shopping. I don't mean the normal activity of shopping. I mean what Os Guinness, in his book Thin Bodies, Fat Minds, calls the cannibalism of POMO. Najat and Fiona have Nat King Cole, Mozart, Carols from Kings, Madonna, Bananarama, and all those other things thrown right together because they just shop for what they like. They don't care that Carols from Kings is saying something fundamentally different from what Madonna is saying. They're just nice, and they like them. And they can construct their own reality, and who cares if it's inconsistent? It doesn't have to be coherent anymore. So, incoherence. Two more quickly. Pluralism. And that's what I mean when I say that Don Carson's book is about one aspect of postmodernism. Don Carson, very, very helpfully, from pages 13 and following, gives a threefold definition of pluralism. And you'll see how it all follows from, first of all, the lack of a meta-narrative, then the incoherence, now on to pluralism. There is what Carson calls empirical pluralism. The sheer factual diversity of religions, traditions, customs, the tolerance which has enabled a proliferation of things in our world. Empirical pluralism. Now, the toleration, which is part and parcel of pluralism, goes back to Christians ourselves. It goes back to the 17th century, 1689, the Act of Tolerance, of Toleration down in England. Now, that was put in place because people believed then that you didn't need to worry about the existence of other things because there were sufficient grounds in Christianity for it to prove its own case. Toleration was founded upon a confidence in the gospel. But that was back in 1689. Now, in 1996, toleration is founded on precisely the opposite of that. That is, that there is no big story. There is no foundation. In fact, modernism itself, these meta-narratives, are just part of the pluralistic scene. So you can dip in and out of rationalism and use the technology that it produces. You can dip in and out of romanticism and watch sloppy films. You can dip in and out of Marxism and be concerned about the emancipation of the worker. You can dip in and out, as Najat and Fiona do, of capitalism. You can dip in and out. It's no problem. It's all there, and it's all there for you. Empirical pluralism. Then Carson describes what he calls cherished pluralism, which is the empirical stuff approved of. Pluralism with approval. And empirical, cherished pluralism begins to say, no one else is mistaken. No one else is mistaken. We approve of the tolerance, and we don't want anybody to be hurt. We don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. We don't want to hurt our own feelings. We don't want to have our feelings hurt by anybody else. We will cherish the pluralism because it protects us and protects other people. So the theory goes. But then third, there is the philosophical or hermeneutical pluralism, which doesn't say no one else is mistaken, but says no one can be wrong because right and wrong are categories that we won't employ anymore. Right and wrong belong to the world of the big stories and coherence and given structures. No one can be mistaken. Least of all me. Least of all me. If I'm going to criticize you, I've got to be open to your criticism of me, and I don't want that. Now that has spawned at a cultural level what we call political correctness, has it not? Najat and Fiona are very, very nice. Fiona is a natural for the customer relations department. She's not going to offend anybody at all. We hope. Liz Templeton, at the human sexuality debate, standing at the front there, and us trying to reason with her or debate against her, and asking her questions which we thought were real clinchers. Asking her if she could support what she's saying from any biblical text. And she stands there with her glasses just disintegrated and boldly says, no. Now, we will never get a Liz Templeton to think our thoughts. Not because she thinks within the same framework but thinks different thoughts, but because she and others think in a fundamentally different way from us. They have fundamentally different horizons in their world. And as far as they are concerned, the Liz Templetons or the Sally McFaigs or the whoever's of this world, what you construct is real. And if you want to construct something which dips in and out of biblical values and biblical texts, but which is what you want the world to be, then that's fine. That's fine. And if you come at me with your biblical texts and ask me if I'm subservient to them, my answer is going to be, I'm not subservient to anything. I cannot be wrong. Now, it would never get stated in as few words as that, but that is the world, the Pomo world, that aspect of the human sexuality debate was coming from. And we need to bear that in mind. We need to bear it in mind. Incoherence, pluralism, and finally, individualism regarding morality. And I haven't put anything there because it's all perfectly obvious by now, isn't it? If you've constructed your own world of meaning, you can construct your own world of what is right or what is wrong. You can construct your own morality. And as long as you share it with a few people, sometimes a lot of people, when something big happens, then that's fine. That's okay. It is a rampant individualism. That presents certain problems, of course. How do you get from is to ought? How do you get from the fact of a man lying in the ditch to the ought of going and helping him? If you've lost the big picture, you have lost the narrative which defines how you respond to the facts. In fact, what are the facts anymore? So if you promise to do something, there might be a language game going on there which says that if you make a promise, you keep it. But if it's just a language game and language is up to you to fill out with your own meaning, then you don't have to keep your promises anymore. And it doesn't really matter if you don't. Because you're not wrong. You're not wrong. So in a sense, individualism regarding to morality begins to spell the end of morality for postmodernists. It is a morality. That is the feature. Well, so much for the Ladybird Book of Postmodernism. I want to leave you with one or two problems that it presents. I don't want to try and give some responses, partly because there isn't much time, but also because if there's ever a gathering in Scotland of people who should work out the responses for themselves, it's this one today. If we can't, who on earth can? Problems, the major ones. First of all, postmodernism is ironically beginning to function like a meta-narrative. And it will, we must assume, fail to deliver the goods of emancipation from the all-confining and restraining narratives that other people have come up with. And it will fail to deliver the goods because if everything is a matter of taste or the individual world, then you can go around saying your building is horrible, your architecture stinks, your morality is not for me, thank you very much. And you have sown the seeds, therefore, of the very oppression that you have sought to evade. Seeds of oppression are as easily cultivated in the soil of individualism as they are in the soil of totalitarianism. I wrote that. not bad. Because once you arm individuals with sufficient money, or guns, or a professionally constructed image, you begin to control them. The number of young girls who have been seriously affected by the images that Madonna has created and recreated. It's appalling. Recent research, can't remember the source exactly, so I'm just calling it recent research, amongst teenage girls from, I think it was about 13 to 17, who do you rate as the number one woman? It was split between Princess Diana and Madonna. Who's saying that people are no longer oppressed? Secondly, you create, if everything's a matter of taste, you create Generation X, as the student generation is sometimes called, and that folk of that age. You create a generation which is rootless, because there is no meaning in which to anchor your life anymore. You create a generation which suffers from the postmodern malaise of insignificance, because you are desperately trying to give yourself your significance, because no meta-narrative exists to give it to you anymore. What do you mean in the world? Why get up in the morning or the afternoon, as the case may be? Finally, for us, there are a whole set of problems. God is not God anymore. God is one site on the World Wide Web, and you can visit him if you want to, and then move away again and look at the others. God is not God. Sin is not sin. Wittgenstein, who wasn't a postmodernist, had a lovely sentence here. This is from Culture and Value. The way to solve a problem you see in life is to live in a way that will make what is problematic disappear. Sin is not sin anymore. Salvation is politically incorrect, because you can't call anyone a sinner, can you? Sanctification is on your own terms. And you're not on your way anywhere, because there's no progress anymore. So where does your eschatology go? And where's heaven? Where's heaven? And so we have a population, increasingly of particularly young people, who have within them an aching void of insignificance, an aching need to know that they belong in a context that is bigger than their own world. And who can provide that? Well, we can. In fact, we are precisely the people to do it. We can preach on Ecclesiastes, and we are preaching to a postmodern world immediately. We can look at Paul in Corinth on Mars Hill, in Athens on Mars Hill, and find the point of entry to a world which is too superstitious and has unknown gods. We can approach the woman at the well, marginalized, lonely, sinful, and reach out with the gospel. So there we are, postmodernism. Thank you.
From the big story, which is God himself. Thank you. I think that it was much clearer than I expected.